We do have with us a very special guest who has come to Fairfield for a very special reason. Welcome, Randy Hobler.
Nice to be here.
So tell our audience what brings you to Fairfield.
Well, I'm here for rehearsals for a musical I've written called Banjo Boy, and I wrote the book, the lyrics, and the music. And, you know, part of something that people don't understand when they see a musical is they're just seeing the very tip of the iceberg, that it's not just the traditional thing of having a lot of different musicians and stagehands and so forth behind the scenes and choreographers and scenic designers and lighting people, but the show itself is constantly polished. And we've had 300 changes, little tiny little improvements, little polishes since I've been here in 10 days, and they continue all through rehearsals. So I'm here to, you know, watch over that, and it's a highly collaborative process, and that's why I'm here.
Randy, this show will be at the Sondheim Center?
Yeah, it's going to be at the Sondheim Performing Arts Center. It's the opening, grand opening, is on August 8th, Friday, August 8th at 7:30.
And is this the first time? I understand this is a world premiere.
It's a world premiere. The show's had a couple of readings, and that's where you have actors standing with the scripts and reading from the scripts, and there's no scenery and there's no choreography and so forth, and they just sing and they read the dialogue. But this is the first time it's been fully produced.
So tell us a little bit about how you came to write The Banjo Boys, and I understand it's about Meredith Willson, and for anyone who's not familiar with that, he was the writer of The Music Man, which mm-hmm. was a very popular musical in the late 1950s and ever since. And he's from Iowa, and The Music Man was set in Mason City, Iowa, which is, I know about now with our new highways, is a little under 3.5 hours from Fairfield. It used to be a lot further. It'll take a lot longer to get there. But what is your connection with Meredith Willson? How did you come to write this?
Well, the Meredith Willson collection starts way back in the 1930s, and there was a radio show called the Maxwell House Hour, and it was sponsored by my grandfather's advertising agency. And my grandfather, Atherton Hobler, hired Meredith Willson to be the musical director of this show. And so he was the musical director. It came out of Los Angeles. And it's one of these things where they had a cavalcade of stars, you know, coming in every week and having guest appearances. And along the way, they became close friends. My father became close friends with Meredith Willson. And in fact, my father was driven by Meredith Willson in the 1930s across the whole United States and taken to Hollywood. He met all these famous people, and he even got him a date with Judy Garland.
Wow. Did you grow up hearing these stories?
I grew up in New Jersey. And fortunate enough to have Meredith Willson visit us at our home in New Jersey. And also I got to visit Meredith Willson in his home in Los Angeles one time, which was a big thrill and part of the planting the seed for the musical, I guess, a long time ago.
And when was that?
Around 1967. You walked into his house, and you were just blown away by two white grand pianos facing one another, white shag rug, and everything in white when you walked in. And this was the inspiration for the last scene we have in Banjo Boy, surprise scene in Banjo Boy, where everything is in white.
Now, how did Meredith Willson, I mean, he wrote more than The Music Man. That is what he's most famous for.
Yeah, again, sort of the good point, the history of Meredith, and I've read everything I can get my hands on about him, is he wrote his very first thing that he wrote, and it's kind of reflected in Banjo Boy, was a senior class song for Mason City High School. And of course, he laughs about it. He laughed about it. But
do they still use it up there?
No, I don't think so. I don't know. That's a great question we could ask. I know some of the people up there in the library and stuff. But he did write a fight song in the 1950s for Iowa State, and he wrote a fight song in the 1950s for the University of Iowa, and both of those are still played to this day. And so occasionally in a given football game, you will hear from both teams playing Meredith Willson songs.
Okay, so I have to ask this question. The title of your play is The Banjo Boy, mm-hmm. and I was getting, you know, I was going to ask you soon, why it was titled that, but you talk about these fight songs for these two competing schools. Is this dueling banjos?
That's funny. I never thought of that, yeah.
Now, why is the play titled Banjo Boy?
Oh, let me get that set. I didn't answer your last question, if I might, about just so people know about Merth Wilson. He composed a ton of classical things and symphonies during his career, and he was the youngest conductor they had in the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra back in the 1920s, and he was on the radio and doing symphonies and all these kinds of things, and he had a number of hit individual songs in the hit parade in the 30s and 40s, and what happened with him was in 1951, Frank Lesser, who wrote Guys and Dolls, said to him, you know, Meredith, you should write a song about your hometown, about your childhood and about your hometown. And six
just
years,
a song?
No, a musical.
A musical, okay.
I should have said. And and so 6 years later, Music Man came alive.
So this was the first musical that he actually wrote.
It was his first musical.
But
and
not
so,
the last.
Not the last. No, then he followed up with The Unsinkable Molly Brown. And I should point out that the 99.9% of all musicals come from something else. They come from a novel, they come from a movie, they come from a book, they come from a play. In the case of Cats, it comes from a poem by T.S. Eliot. But in Meredith Wilson's case, it was a totally original story. And a lot of what I've interwoven into Banjo Boy is also original, so it's important to understand that. So he was comfortable writing the songs, but he had never written a musical before, and people underestimate what it takes, because what I've learned is literally every second. You have to have the audience riveted every second, whatever's happening on the stage during a musical.
How long did it take him to write The Music Man?
It took him 6 years, and it's taken me 6 years so far, exactly, on Banjo Boy. That's the gestation period for a musical, at least.
For a successful musical.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of musicals that come out that are slapdash together, and they're not very good, and they disappear pretty quickly.
Now, do you have a similar background in terms of composition?
Everybody's background is different, and I think that's what's fascinating about people, like, you know, the 8 million stories in the Naked City. In my case, I started to play piano when I was a little kid, and started to take lessons. I had started playing by ear and still play by ear. Started to take lessons, and I was only 5 years old, and they were trying to cram all this classical music down me, and I didn't like it, but I didn't know what classical was or popular. I didn't know those terms, and so I quit. I was a very difficult kind of person. And interestingly, Meredith Wilson had a problem with one of his piano teachers as well. And then I sort of got back into music in my early teens and started playing five-string banjo when the Kingston Trio came along, and that was all popular. And then I very quickly picked up guitar, and in high school I played in a rock and roll band, and then in college played guitar in another rock and roll band. It was a very good one, and we made a recording for ABC Paramount. It never went any place. And then I learned how to play trumpet after that. So I play a number of different instruments, and so I had that sort of musical background. And in terms of composing, what I would do is, you know, there's a song in The Music Man, they call it a partner song, where you have, he took 76 trombones and he made it very slow, and he called it Goodnight My Someone, and she sings, Goodnight My Someone, Goodnight My, let's just say, that's 76 trombones, I see, and they sing it together.
Right.
And
right.
So I picked up on that idea, and I would write a harmony to the birthday song. And for my grandmother's 75th birthday, sang this song. And it sounded, you don't know, it sounds like an original song. And the last verse, all my sisters would come in 3-part harmony and sing happy birthday to that. And then I did the same thing with my sister when she got married. I did Here Comes the Bride. But first you just hear the harmony to it. And then at the end, in comes Here Comes the Bride, and it all harmonizes. And then in Banjo Boy, we have a wonderful moment between Meredith and the girl he falls in love with, where she sings this song from earlier in the show that seems to be just its own song, but it turns out it's a harmony to America the Beautiful. And when they sing it together, it's a beautiful partner song.
Cool. So have you composed music prior to doing the Banjo Boy?
Yeah, I mean, you know, after doing those partner songs, when we had the rock and roll song in college, I wrote a few songs, but I didn't really know what I was doing. And then I wrote songs. I was working for Encyclopedia Britannica Films, and I wrote some songs for that and started to compose. And then I wrote a song. I was really thrilled. I was working at IBM and helping with these corporate spectaculars they have. And we had a former Miss America, Vonda Van Dyke from Chicago, came in and sang a song of mine called One Perfect Day. And I was so thrilled to have a former Miss America sing my song.
Do you have a recording of that?
I do. And her voice is beautiful.
Oh,
and
she has one lung. You should bring it in. We can play it.
Okay.
That would be great.
Yeah. So that sort of composing was going on. And then my girlfriend, Alexa, who got the idea for Banjo Boy, or the idea of, Randy, why don't you do a musical about this? Because we went to the Mason City in 2002 for the 100th anniversary of Meredith Willson's birth. And when the idea came up, and when I fell in love with her, I wrote her an entire album of songs and composed them, and each song was in a different style. Like, one was as if, you know, it was Elvis Presley, so it was called Heartmate, you know, and it sounded like Elvis and so forth. And so I was composing along at that point, and then maybe 10 years later, this idea came along for Banjo Boy.
Now, other than the rock music, you know, the rock bands that you played, like in college, have mm-hmm. you ever been a professional performer?
No, I mean, rock and roll, I'm comfortable performing because, you know, we performed hundreds of times, but haven't performed with any other groups of any kind since, yeah.
It seems like taking on the writing of a musical is a pretty major commitment.
It's a major commitment of time, and I've spent 3 hours a day for the last 6 years on it. It's like a second job.
Wow.
But it's not, you know, it's a labor of love, so it doesn't drain any energy from
it. Now, it was your girlfriend's suggestion that you do this, and like you said, it was Guy Lesser's suggestion that Meredith Willson write a musical.
Yeah, Frank Lesser.
Frank Lesser, right, sorry. Yeah. Guys and Dolls.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And so anyway, it's your girlfriend's suggestion that you do this. You've been working on it for 6 years. Does she ever regret having made that suggestion?
I think she's basically very supportive, you know, and she's, you know, she's very smart. She knows when to back off, and she knows when to weigh in, and she knows, because it's very difficult. She's also smart enough to know that nobody really knows whether a song is going to work or not. The only thing that's going to make a song or something work in a show is just the audience like it. And in fact, I was talking to some of the folks today. Oftentimes, the audience will laugh at something, and it's not a laugh line, it's not a punchline. But afterwards, you realize why they were laughing. In Banjo Boy, there's his younger sister Dixie says the words, "I have a hope." Well, it doesn't sound very funny, but in context, there's this build-up to it, and when she says that, the audience roars. So,
and were you expecting that? Or
no,
that
no,
that's
what's
unexpected.
So much fun. And sometimes you write something you think it's funny, and they don't. I have a joke about Herbert Hoover in the show, because it takes place in 1928 when he was elected, and there's a number of references to Hoover and Iowa, some fun things. And it didn't work, and this is the other trick when you're polishing in a musical is, it's not black and white. It's not like this works or it doesn't work. That's a big mistake if you think that way. Sometimes the lighting is wrong. Sometimes the actor didn't pause and deliver the line. Sometimes there was a musical cue that was missed. There's some little thing that wasn't quite right. So you'd be very careful before you throw something out or whatever if the audience doesn't react. And with the Herbert Hoover joke, I realized that I needed his name at the end of the joke, and I'd used his name in the beginning of the joke, and so it didn't work before, and now it works.
That small a change was all
it took. Little tiny things. And of course, part of my self-education for the show was just reading everything I could get my hands on about the development of Camelot and you know, My Fair Lady and all these other musicals. You can learn a lot by just reading about mistakes that people have made and so forth. And many, many times there have been cases. In fact, even with Music Man, at the very beginning of Music Man, where they have the guys doing coming in on the train and so forth and doing that fast talking, at first it didn't seem to work, and they were going to throw the whole number out. And then they realized, they asked some audience members afterwards, and they said, oh, we thought this was just something going on before the real musical, because there was no music being played. They're used to music, and these guys are just chanting on this train. And so it's the one about, you got to know the territory, and they're just chanting vocally, so they thought it was some warm-up act or something. And so they introduced a little bit of music to have the audience stop and look, and then, of course, it became great.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest today is Randy Hoebler, who's the author and composer of Banjo Boy. This is having its world premiere at the Sondheim Center for the Performing Arts on August 8th at 7:30. And how long is the run?
It's going to have 9 performances. They can go to the iowatix.com, www.iowatix.com, to see the exact times. So there's matinees, and there's 2 o'clock and 7:30 are the evening shows, and it's between the 8th and the 17th.
So, Randy, why is Meredith Wilson the banjo boy?
funny thing. I had initially seen this kind of thing as Meredith rebelling against his father, because the whole story is about his issues with his father and how they might have been resolved had he gone back in time. And the little fun and I think unique theatrical trick in this show is that the whole show starts off with Meredith Wilson in heaven. And he says, you know what, I'm going to go back and change 3 notes of my life. And one of the things I want to change is my relationship with my father and make it work. And so he goes back in time. And so what we're seeing in Banjo Boy is actually history happening, but being changed, his own story, but being changed in certain key ways with respect to these 3 things in his life. And so I had conceived of his father being a Harold Hill-like guy, who was the bandmaster for the Mason City High School band and into all these band instruments. And I wanted him to rebel. And I said, you know, the instrument that would be most unlike, you know, that the worst thing for his father would be for him to choose a banjo. So it was like a sign of rebellion for him to choose a banjo. And then I found out 2 years after I came up with the idea of banjo that Meredith Wilson had actually played banjo, not only in a little group, but also he had played banjo in the high school orchestra in Mason City.
So you were planning to make him a banjo player without realizing that he was a banjo player.
And I didn't realize it. And then there's a guy named Terry Harrison, who is the archivist at the Mason City Library, who got me actual pictures of Meredith Wilson playing this banjo. And then all these coincidences started piling up. It turned out his mother's favorite expression was banjos and prayers. It turned out that John Philip Sousa, who is plays a large role in this show, had a horse named Banjo once that threw him. So I was able to work that into the script. And then it turns out that the banjo came from its early form from Africa, and it was fine-tuned in the United States by black people, which plays into the Louis Armstrong part of this and other diversity themes in the show. And then it turns out it's the only instrument invented in America, fine-tuned in America. You know, all the other instruments in a band come from different countries. So this all works into the plot.
That's really a lot of kind of coincidences.
Lots of coincidences, yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, all along the way, I had a concept for which I thought would be very fun. I'd never heard it before, where there would be a marriage scene between Meredith Wilson and his girlfriend, where the minister would be uttering the marriage vows as spoonerisms. And spoonerisms are things like my grandfather on my mother's side was fond of these, is when people talk and say, and then came the blushing crow, or Martin me, Padam, let me sew you to another sheet, right? When people mix up things. So I've changed the marriage ceremony around to have all these funny reversals of the words, and I was originally going to call him, instead of Spooner, Forker, F-O-R-K-E-R, and then I kept researching Meredith Wilson's background, and he knew a guy and was friends with a guy in San Francisco named Forker.
For heaven's sakes.
Yeah.
When you decided to go ahead and do this and write this, do you start with music? Do you start with the story? How did you start?
Well, luckily, my girlfriend also was lucky enough to have known Ed Kleban, who was the lyricist for Chorus Line. And he had just, in casual conversation, mentioned to her, first, do the story. And so she said that to me. And I said, why? And she said, you know, as a musical person, you're going to want to just write music, but you have to hold off because the songs have to emerge from the story. You can't just plaster artificially or paste songs onto the story. So I went for 2 years researching and writing and doing the book, the script, but not writing a single note. I had ideas for songs, and I jot them down, but I didn't write anything because I wanted it to emerge. And so an example of that, which resulted thankfully in her advice, all along, but I mean, just one example in the show is the younger sister, Dixie, wants to be in the boys' band, and the dad keeps telling her she can't be in the boys' band. She plays clarinet. And so she stamps her feet, you know, she's throwing a tantrum, and that stamping of her feet becomes the rhythm for this song. It's called Why Can't a Girl? You know, why can't a girl do this? Why can't a girl do that? Why can't a girl dream of this and that? And so she's complaining about this. And it flows so naturally because if you think about it, it's very artificial. People don't, you know, in their everyday conversation don't suddenly burst into song. So you have to have something that really builds up to it. So what I did was I took a, you know, that You Got Trouble is a very rhythmic speech, and that thing about it doesn't have territory is very rhythmic. And so I had her start to do this rhythmic thing as if she were mocking all the people who were telling her she can't do stuff. And so it inevitably leads to the song. And so she says stuff like, Dixie, be a lady. Dixie, be polite. Temper, temper, temper. Don't put up a fight. And it goes on like this, all rhyming. And then it reaches the point where she can't express it anymore in words, and she bursts into song.
This really sounds like a wonderful show.
I think it is, but I'm prejudiced about it.
Now, had you ever written a book, a play, short stories, or was this your first foray?
Oh, no, no, and it would be crazy to do that without having some background. And again, it's everyone's story is different. But in my case, I've been nationally published in lots of articles. I've written on various topics, and I'd written a screenplay that was not made into a screenplay. I've written a novel that was not made into a novel. When I was working at IBM, one of my jobs is to write what we called continuity, which was humor for the vice presidents to interact with the various people who were, you know, guest stars that they had and so forth. So that there are all those sort of writing and creative things going on all the time. And, you know, I was able to bring that to bear on writing the musical. But musicals have very specific ways of doing humor, and you don't realize that there's many flavors of humor as there are languages, and you just have to zero in on the things that really work in the theater.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm Monica Hadley, and with me today is Randy Hopler, the author and composer of Banjo Boy, which you, I hope you all are able to see. Is it over 3 weekends beginning August 8th?
August 8th through August 17th, and nine performances.
Yeah. And Randy's been here in Fairfield with us working on the all the rehearsals and making changes. And you say there's been over 300
little changes.
Little changes.
All, you know, suddenly the director will say, let's do this. Or the choreographer will say, oh, let's try this. And then someone will say, oh, let's do this. Or I will come up with an idea. And in fact, just today we put a new song in the show, which I just finished yesterday, and I showed it to the director. He says, this is perfect. This is great. We'll put it in.
So it's a work in process.
Absolutely.
And how does it feel for you as, you know, you've devoted all these years to this? Is it hard at all sometimes to have someone say, well, let's change this or let's do this differently?
The way it works in the theater, it's highly collaborative, and in effect, it reaches the point, sort of like, you know, the Flying Angels or any kind of very tight teamwork, where if everyone's on the same level playing field and all very collaborative and very open and willing to discuss, it's as if you're one brain and you make the decisions collectively and there are no hard feelings and everything's better for it.
But this is your first experience with this process.
No, in my day job, I'm a marketing consultant, and so I've done a lot of work working with creative people at agencies, advertising agencies, and in fact, I train people on how do you work with them, and there's all kinds of issues that I've been through for 30 years dealing with creative folks and how you best deal with that.
So, Randy, what is it about Meredith Willson's story that inspired you to such a degree that you wanted to make this commitment to writing this musical?
Well, I think the opening song, which I think is a wonderful theme-setting song for this show, is called I'll Follow My Song. And it's the idea that he wants to be a composer no matter what. And I understand that, being a composer. So for myself, I have this inner need to compose. And, it's one of those things that you'll do it whether you're paid or not. You'll do it. So the passion is there to do that. So that latent passion was there for me to to do it anyway. And then it got focused in on the personal relationship I had with him, as well as realizing as I developed it that his story wasn't told. I mean, when you think about The Music Man, all these things happen, but there's nothing in there about someone who's a character who is, in effect, Meredith. It's all about this con man who comes into town and his love story and so forth. So there's little echoes of things in there. Like there's a thing where Winthrop has a problem with Harold Hill, and I realize now that what that's coming from is his own relationship with his father, but there's just these very subtle little hints in there.
And how did you go about finding out the real story, Meredith Wilson?
Oh, yeah. I mean, what you do is you try to just immerse yourself. And he wrote three biographical books. I read those. And then, of course, what happens is you start writing the story. Did he do that? Was it that? Oh, you go back, you know. So I've reread those about six or seven times, iteratively each time throughout the whole process. And then you seek out newspaper articles. And just the other day, if anybody wants to see Meredith Wilson, the fabulous thing for those who are on the internet, we just found this as part of this process. I didn't know it was there. The man who plays the elder Meredith, Chris Bush, who's a local guy, said, you know, I'd like to see a video of Meredith Wilson. And I said, I don't have one. He said, I'll just look for one on YouTube. And I said, of course. So I looked it up. And if anybody's interested, there was a show in the 1950s called I've Got a Secret with Gary Moore. Meredith Wilson appeared on it, and he's on it for 15 minutes. And it's called INDA, I-N-D-A, Good Old Sommerstein is the name of the YouTube. Then it's two YouTubes. And it shows Meredith Wilson conducting all these people whose first and or last names constitute the lyrics for In the Good Old Summertime. But the closest they could get to Summertime was Sommerstein, and it's just hilarious as he conducts these people, and they have little things coming up showing their names as they sing it. So, I mean, and this is on YouTube, and so you get to see Meredith Wilson. Yeah.
Wow. I didn't realize they put old TV clips YouTube.
There's new stuff, and there's old stuff, too. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful archive.
It sure is. Yeah. It's none of us are going to be able to be totally anonymous in the future, you know, because everything ends up on YouTube. Now, tell us a little bit more about Meredith Wilson as, you know, what his story is. You know, he came from Mason City, has this problem with his father.
Well, there's two stories of Meredith Wilson, right? There's his professional story, which is very successful, and there's a personal story, which was not. He divorced from his first wife. He married the girl next door. She didn't want to have kids. He did. And that didn't work out. Then he married Renee, who was here in Fairfield with him when he gave a commencement speech at Parsons, and they have pictures of that at the theater when you go to see it. And she was half French, half Russian, very exotic, just like the way we portray that sort of thing in Banjo Boy. And then she died of cancer, and he married Rosemary, who's still alive. She's 86 years old and living in Los Angeles. And he had a nice, very nice and loving relationship with Rosemary, obviously, for many years. He died in 1984, so she's still around. And his relationship with his father was so bad that his father never acknowledged what he had accomplished. He had been himself in Sousa's band, and his father never acknowledged it.
Wow, that's just incredible.
Yeah, and so I think as a result of that relationship with his father that was missing, combined with the fact that he didn't have kids, in 1955 he founded the Los Angeles chapter of the Big Brothers of Los Angeles, and he was its president for six terms. And in 1962, we have a picture of President Kennedy giving him the Big Brother of the Year Award, National Big Brother of the Year Award.
Now, you keep mentioning John Philip Sousa and Louis Armstrong. What was Meredith Wilson's relationship with those two?
When Meredith Wilson was young, his best instrument was flute, and what he did was he played for 2 years with the Sousa band and toured the United States. So he was just, that meant he was just like up there. And in those days, that was being like the Beatles. I mean, it was really a big thing. So he knew Sousa well. Interestingly enough, I went through and I was able to find an old rare book of the actual script of The Music Man, and Sousa is only mentioned once in the whole show. It seems like it's more, but it was only once. So I thought, you know, we could really take this and run with it and have him meet him as a young man. And there's a lot of ways that are too complicated to describe here where Sousa plays into this show. But we have a wonderful scene, which I call it like the Rain in Spain scene, where he meets John Philip Sousa in San Francisco, and he's got his banjo, and he's been writing this song, which is one of the big songs at the end of the show. And he says, oh, I've written a song. And John Philip Sousa says, well, let's hear it. And he says, well, my dad says it's no good. It's just notes. And John Philip Sousa said, well, no song is good at first. We just have to fine-tune it. And there's this wonderful scene where he coaches him through how to make this song work. So that was how we sort of, in Banjo Boy, reflected that relationship with Sousa. For Louis Armstrong, Louis Armstrong was actually in on a couple of the shows that Meredith Willson had. So they knew each other. So that's historically true. The way we've made it happen here is not historically as if he came on his radio show. But in the 1920s, when this takes place, Louis Armstrong had a band, including, in fact, with a banjo player, called the Hot Five. And he toured all over the United States. So we engineered a meeting between him, a dramatic meeting to him and Louis Armstrong in Omaha, the Omaha train station, when he's running away from home and he's kicked off a freight train. And he meets Louis Armstrong, and they have this wonderful, our showstopper song, Thanks Be to Music, which is sung.
So that one might not be entirely factually based.
Yeah, it's more like the whole thing is that there are 104 true things in the show, so it's permeated with all the realities of his life. But what happens is, as I said, is his father, he went, for example, he ran away from home when he was young, a teenager, and went east. And one of the three things which has changed is we're going to have him move west. So at the beginning, he declares he's going to move west. Well, as soon as anybody, everybody in all our lives has these little forks in the road, and we make decisions to do something else or not. And once you change anything in your life, everything else starts changing. And so what I had to very carefully think through is, well, if he went west, what would happen? Well, if he's going west on the train, Louis Armstrong could have been out there. They could have run into one another. And so
Randy, what made you decide to do this story in this way, where it's almost an alternate biography of Meredith Willson?
Exactly.
The actual biography.
It's a great question. Well, part of the problem is, I mean, his life itself wasn't that dramatic. And so you need to have something dramatic about it. And also, there's this sort of subtext going on here where the Banjo Boy is like a sequel to The Music Man and a prequel to The Music Man, because there's all these parts of his own life that ended up in Music Man. For example, he had a friend named Charlie Havredegrain, and Charlie Havredegrain had a lisp, and he became Winthrop in The Music Man. So I took Charlie Havredegrain and put him in to the show as a friend of his, which he was. And just yesterday, and this is another amazing coincidence, just yesterday, the actor here, who is going to be playing Stephen Crisp, who's going to be playing Charlie Havredegrain, came to me and said, I'd like to dye my hair red for the show. And I said, do you know what a coincidence that is? And he didn't.
Because he really was a redhead?
He was a Eddie Hodges, who played Winthrop in the original Music Man, and Ron Howard, who's now the famous director, who played him in the movie in 1962 with Shirley Jones and with Robert Preston, also had red hair.
Oh, and this actor did not know.
He had no idea. It's like it was in the air, and it just something hit him, and he just like red hair. I was just blown away.
Didn't it? It seems like doing this story in this way makes it very complex, and adds a lot of sort of levels to the whole thing.
That's a very insightful observation. If you're doing your job right, you will have levels, but the levels will be simultaneous, and the top level will be simple. So the top level, you know, like this is a show for the whole family. It's very clean. When the original Music Man came out, Walter Kerr, who was the reviewer for the Herald Tribune in the day, big reviewer, described the Music Man as something you could take a nun to and not be embarrassed. Mm-hmm. So in that spirit, a banjo boy is just totally clean. And so we have, I forgot what your question was. Oh, the levels, yes. So on a level, the whole family could come, because you could take a six-year-old to the show, and they would see the physicality and things going on, and the obvious and the nice, catchy tunes, and they would appreciate that. And then as you get teenagers and adults and so forth, they will see some of these deeper levels of things going on. There's a diversity theme, for example, in the show, which we never use the word diversity anyplace, but adults can infer it as they watch, as they experience this on different levels. And so I hope that, I mean, the word complex sounds like it's not, you can't follow it, or it's not an easy story, but it's a very easy story, and you don't use fancy language, and you don't make it complicated, and you let it breathe. And if I've succeeded, and I hope we have, and especially with all the improvements we've been making in the last 2 weeks, it'll flow very nicely, but you can experience it on these deeper levels.
I'm Monica Hadley, and with me today on Writers' Voices is Randy Hobler. We're talking about the premiere performance upcoming at the Sondheim Center of Banjo Boy, the story of Iowa's own music man, Meredith Wilson. Meredith Wilson was a very famous composer. He was working in the 1920s and 30s.
And 40s.
And 40s and, yeah. And 50s. And the Music Man was set. What time period was that set in?
Music Man was set in 1911-1912. And the way it's constructed is we're pretending that Meredith Wilson was born in 1912 and it takes place in 1928 when he would be in the show 16, or had Harold Hill and Marion Perrault gotten married, they would have had a child probably, in their first child would have been born in 1912 and would be 16 in 1928.
And Harold Hill and Marion are
the characters, the two lead characters in The Music Man.
And when I'm reading about your process of researching for the show, it mentions that you researched the time, the fashion, the politics, San Francisco, which was, of course, where Meredith Wilson worked for a long time, sounds like, yeah. And also Chinese Americans, Louis Armstrong, John Philip Sousa. We talked about Louis Armstrong and John Philip Sousa. What do Chinese Americans have to do with this story?
Well, he was obviously a different kid, right? I mean, he left from the small town in Iowa and went to the big city and became a big success. So obviously he had a lot of talent, and he must have felt like he needed to get out. And in fact, our second song in the show is called Out of Here, and all the kids are singing about wanting to get out of here. And he does get out of here, and the other kids don't, you know. And so he wanted to get out, and he felt different. And then as we've seen, and this is an example of the layering, he was rebelling against his dad, so he picks the banjo, gets a different instrument, and then he tells his mom he wants a different kind of girl. And this is one of the things that he didn't do, because he did not originally marry a different girl. He married the girl next door. In fact, the girl's maiden name was also Wilson. Talk about close. So he married a Wilson. So he now, okay, the elder Meredith is coming down from heaven and suggesting, whispering in his ear, hey, get somebody different. So then he sings a song called Different, you know, I want a different girl. So he wants a different instrument, he wants a different girl, he wants, and so forth. So this is all preparing us for when he goes to San Francisco, and he has no money. So the only place he can stay in San Francisco, inevitably, is in Chinatown, where I'd researched this, very cheap rents. And so he finds a place to let in Chinatown, and the girl who is working there is a girl named Ziling, which means beautiful pieces of jade, and she's the girl that he falls in love with, much as later on he married a very exotic woman from half French, half Russian. So then, of course, now we have this very colorful Chinatown and this colorful woman, and I had to research Chinese Americans, and oh boy, I didn't realize how they were oppressed in the United States for many years until I did all this research. And so that is kind of worked into the plot as well.
And you also, so you talk about the prejudice that they experienced quite a bit in this.
Yeah, what people don't know is there's a place that's still there called Angel Island in San Francisco. And this was like this detention place where all the Chinese immigrants had to come from the 1850s until I think they closed it down in 1941 or something. And what would happen is the Chinese were questioned for upwards of 6 weeks. This is like Guantanamo all over again, or Abu Ghraib. It's like this questioning, and they would separately question different members of the family because they were afraid that people were trying to come in illegally according to what the rules were, and they had to have their stories consistent. So these Chinese coming over in these boats, which took 2 or 3 weeks in those days, would memorize hundreds and hundreds of facts about who their cousins were and where their village was and all this to make sure they all had their stories the same. And if they got one thing wrong, they'd send them back.
Wow. Now, do you ever think of how interesting it is that Meredith Willson had to get out of Iowa, you know, wanted to leave Iowa, had to get out to become successful, and here you are having to come back to Iowa to do the same thing that he had to leave Iowa for.
Yeah. Well, he did come back to Iowa, and we have there's a lot of parallelisms in my show where he leaves and then he comes back in triumph. And of course, Meredith Willson left and came back in triumph, for example. I mean, on many occasions, but I mean, in 1962, when they had the big opening for the movie, The Music Man, he came back, and they had this big band with 76 trombones and all the rest. So he came back in triumph also. And so we parallel that. He comes back with their banjo boys. And part of the story is that his dad's band that he had been very proud of has dwindled to only 4 kids. And to make it seem like he's got more kids in the band, he has these little cutouts of musicians sitting in the stands to make it look like the band's bigger. So he's very worried about this. And so the son comes back with these banjo boys to do a different thing to help, you know, win the Iowa Band Contest. And I'd done research on that, too. The very first Iowa Band Contest was in 1928, so it takes place in that same time period.
Randy, let's talk a little bit more about your writing process, how you went about writing this. You say you started with the story. Did you get the, before you actually even started composing songs at all? So you started with research.
Right.
And then you started writing story.
Yeah, well, it sort of overlaps. So what happens in your process is you start to do research, and this is true for any research, for anything anybody ever is researching, whether they're writing novels or history or researching something they're going to do in business. But as you're researching, you get ideas. So while you're researching, you get an idea, and you just note it down someplace, and you start collecting all these ideas, and those ideas start building up, and then you start noticing patterns and say, oh, this could be that, and you could add this and so forth. But you're still researching. And then it reaches the point where the research sort of tapers off, although there's still additional research things to be done. And then what comes up is working on the structure. And then you work a lot on the structure of the story. And there's a lot of changes that happen because you say, well, this couldn't happen. What if this happened, this, it couldn't be that. And you have to make it all make sense and be very logical.
Do you sit down when you're writing a musical like this? And I'm sure different writers have different methods of doing it, but do you sit down and start writing the dialogue between people, or do you outline the story first?
Well, in terms of dialogue, even little snatches of dialogue, you'll come out of the research. So I noticed there were a couple of things, like there was a quote from Meredith Willson's, one of his biographies, where he said, "My father was like a granite institution." So I put that into the show. And then his mother had various expressions that she would use, these religious expressions, so we put those in. So, again, as you're researching, you capture these things, which might be a scenery idea, it might be a dialogue idea, it might be a prop idea. We just did a thing yesterday, one of the 300 improvements, and it's one of those V8 moments where you say, of course, duh. She was religious, not in a very serious kind of way, but she's a seriously religious person, and we didn't have a family Bible on the set as a prop, and so we introduced that yesterday. So in terms of the writing process, yeah, you sort of capture these things as you go along, and so what happens, it's sort of like when you're doing a jigsaw puzzle, and you have the different pieces are there, but there's all these holes, but there is an overall structure, and then you start filling in the holes and moving things around.
And you go back and you make revisions and you add things and you take things out. And somewhere in here it said that when Meredith Willson was writing The Music Man, there were 22 songs that didn't make it to the final, through the final
cut. And
in the day,
it's no coincidence that the 1950s were the golden age of musicals. Guys and Dolls, My Fair Lady, The Music Man. The Music Man is still performed 500 times a year in the United States. That's more than once a day. I mean, that's 51 years later. I mean, that's a tribute to it. And, of course, with My Fair Lady and The Music Man, what happens is lots of songs are written. Some of them are wonderful songs. There's CDs you can get. I forget where you can look on the Internet, I guess. But there's CDs you can get of these rejected songs from these various musicals. And some of the ones, I've heard the ones from The Music Man, some of them are wonderful songs. But, first of all, there's a mathematical limit as to how many songs can go into a show. And perhaps the single most important thing, aside from the quality of the song, is fit. How well does this song fit right here? And so he had a lot of wonderful, these 22 songs, most of them are pretty good, but the other ones were just better.
Now, have you also had songs that you wrote for Banjo Boy that have not made it to the final cut?
Yeah, I've had about 6 or 7 or 8 songs that either because I chose to drop it or as part of the collaborative process, we decided to drop it. We have a very funny, I tried it not just, it's not just dialogue, you know, when you're writing, it's the props, and it's what we have in this show is we have a lot of visual running jokes. We have sound jokes. We have some of the props that you laugh at. We even have some silences that are funny in the song. So, one of the things we have is a very funny running joke is, you know, this concept of the alpha female, where there's the female who dictates to all her friends, you know, how they're going to dress and so forth. Well, we've integrated this into the show. And there's the alpha female's name, Stacy, and then she has these two friends, Gracie. And Lacey. Anyway, they all rhyme. So it's funny, and they're always copying the lead and so forth. So one of the jokes is at one point she says, "I think the smart thing to wear is acorn." And then two scenes later, they're all dressed like acorns. You know, so it's visually funny. So I had written a song, which is a perfectly good song, and maybe it would be a great song for a show about alpha females, but this show isn't about the alpha females. So it's like seasoning, right? You can't put in too much salt, too much pepper, just the right amount. So we have the seasoning of these cheerleaders who are comic figures, but making a point about conformity. We never use the word conformity, but they're conforming like crazy throughout this thing. And I wrote this song called Me Too, because Stacy says something and the next one says, me too. So I wrote a song, you know, and the chorus of it is very catchy, and it goes, me too, what else is there to say? If you long to belong, there's no other way. And it's got clever little rhymes in there, it's very catchy, and it's all them copying one another. But it just took up too much time, it made too much focus on the girls and not on the boys. So now what we have in there is the girls are sitting there reading about Olga Baklanova, who was this actress, funny name, you know, from the 1920s, and they're reading Photoplay magazine, which was the Us magazine of the day, and they're oohing and eyeing over her T-strap shoes and all this. And so Meredith comes over, and he composes on the fly a limerick-type song about Olga Baklanova, making funny rhymes about her and about her life and shoes and all this, and then they sort of just totally reject that, and then it's more about him and the composing than about them.
Now, part of most musicals that I've seen, a big part is the choreography and the dance numbers. Did you think about that aspect of it too as you were writing, or is that something that gets layered on?
That's a great question. I of course had researched a lot of this, and what's considered a best practice, and this is what Richard Rodgers would do and so forth, and Stephen Sondheim and all these guys, is it's the job of the writer to sort of throw out a basic sort of concept for the choreography, but don't go into a lot of detail. That's up to the choreographer. So in this show, for example, we have this showstopper song called Thanks Be to Music, and Louis Armstrong is doing it. And in the middle of the song, he goes snap, clap, slap, which means thigh slaps, and then tap. And the thigh slapping was just something that was part of the song. And Adam Cates, who's our wonderful choreographer, picked up on that, and he's created a choreography number which incorporates thigh slapping and more, all kinds of body slapping and kinds of things in a very artistic, upbeat kind of an original kind of way into the song. And so it's up to him to say, okay, you three dancers in the corner hit your thighs on this beat, and these three move over here and hit your heads together, and you two chest bump here, whatever he does. That's up to the choreographer. But he picked up on that basic concept and took it to the next level.
Now, the next time that the Banjo Boys is, or Banjo Boy is performed somewhere else, will they be starting from scratch on choreography, or is it likely to build on the choreography that was done here?
That's a great question. It varies. Sometimes choreographers will write out all the choreography using all the professional choreographer protocols. And when you have time to do that and the money to do that, that's great. I know we don't really have that much in this particular case, but we are going to make on one of the performances an archival video of it, so that can be used as a reference point. And I personally would love to have them pick up on that. Each choreographer is going to want to put their own stamp on whatever they do, but I would love it for them to pick up on what Adam has developed.
Now, how did it come to be that this world premiere is happening here in Fairfield?
Part of it is my being a very thorough person, and over the course of the last 6 years, in addition to doing research, in addition to writing and everything else, is you have to find a venue for it. When you're unknown, someone like Jerry Herman, when he was unknown and people wouldn't give him the time of day, nor do people give me the time of day. So you have to go out and be your own producer as a writer. It's an extra burden you have. So I, you know, from various sources, and there's no one source. You have to go to multiple sources, and these sources are changing because theaters are going out of business or moving and whatever. So I've got 54 pages of all these theaters, right, in the United States, and some of them are called presenting theaters. I didn't know about that, but the presenting theaters just take existing shows. You know, oh, we're going to do Footloose, we're going to do My Fair Lady, and that's all they do. It's existing shows. Then they have producing theaters, which is the Sondheim Center. It's sort of a mix of the two, and they also produce. And they have staff and folks on staff that can do that. And here we have Randy West. And so you identify what all these theaters are, and you identify, you know, put aside the ones that are just doing the existing musicals are presenting, and you start contacting them. Oh, I contacted Randy, and I somehow got wind of the Sondheim Center opening last year in 2007. And, of course, I said to Randy, look, you know, this is all about Iowa, so it seems like a good fit. And he was considering lots of different musicals, as he always is. I guess you'd have to talk to him about his own process, but clearly, I mean, I guess he agreed with me that he thought this was wonderful and appropriate. And
are there any other producing theaters in Iowa, or is this pretty much it?
I'd have to go to my list, but this is the premiere in Iowa. The Sondheim Center is really the premiere. I know there's I've seen things just going through Iowa City and stuff where they seem to be presenting existing musicals and so forth. But I'd have to go to my list because I've got, you know, literally 500 or 600, you know, theaters listed.
What are your plans for the Banjo Boy after this?
Obviously you want to have it go to another place. Ideally, it would go to another venue and for a longer period of time. And then after that, ideally go to Broadway if you can do it. And I've even worked into the opening song of the show, Broadway or Bust. So that's personal.
Now, how common is it for a new composer/author to actually get to write a musical and have it produced professionally, and, you know, even and then to make it to Broadway? Is this pretty uncommon?
Well, you know, a lot of theater in the United States is under the radar. We're so inundated with TV and radio and so forth, but it is a vibrant, alive process. As I said before, Music Man is played 500 times a year. Fiddler on the Roof 500 times a year. So there's literally tens of thousands of productions going on. There's all kinds of community theaters in Iowa that are doing community level stuff, not professional level like Sondheim, but there are a number of community theaters, probably about 14 or 15 of them that I know of in Iowa. And there are thousands of people out there with their own musicals, and they're all pushing and trying to get them done. And, you know, the cream rises to the top, usually. Sometimes there are exceptions where people, a lot of money, they recently did something on Broadway called The Pirate Queen, and the people who had done either Miss Saigon or Les Mis or something, just on the strength of their name and the fact they had money, put on the show, but it wasn't very good, and it closed very quickly. So the thing that really makes it come alive is there's probably about 16 major rehearsal studios in New York City, and these are just, they're just these buildings. People walk by them all the time, and you go in there anytime from 10 o'clock in the morning till midnight, and the hallways are swarming with actors and actresses, and you hear opera singers singing, and you hear people singing all these songs and so forth. So it's a very vibrant kind of thing that's going on.
So, Randy, you're really kind of in the middle of a dream come true.
Mm-hmm. You named it.
And we'd like to invite our entire listening audience to come and share that with you beginning August 8th at the Sondheim Center here in Fairfield. And you can find out more information at the website for the Convention Center, which is, I believe, facc.com. I hope I got that right.
I think it's also Sondheim Center.
I think so. And also, you can get tickets at iowatix.com. That's iowatix.com. And hope to see you all there. Thank you so much for joining us today, Randy.
Thanks for having me.
And stay tuned if you're listening on Friday to Planet Erstwhile with James Moore. If you're listening Monday morning, please stay tuned for The Cult Show. And see you next week on Writer's Voices.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.